Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. In this talk, delivered on March 8th as part of Winter Weekend 2014, Raymond Miller presents An Unhappy Wanderer on the Streets of St. Petersburg, Raskolnikov as Superfluous Man. Raymond Miller is recently retired from Bowdoin College, where he taught Russian language and literature for 30 years. He has lectured and written extensively on Pan-Slavism and the history of Romanticism in East Central Europe. In this talk, Miller discusses the phenomenon of the superfluous man in Russian literature, and the ways in which Crime and Punishment's Raskolnikov does and does not fit with his predecessors in that category.
I used to get the Sporting News, America's oldest sports magazine, and they would regularly feature profiles of selected athletes. They would have them fill out a standard questionnaire, which would be illuminated by brief commentary here and there. Once they profiled a hockey goaltender from Siberia, Ilya Bryzgalov, who, to the question, who is the person you most admired, answered Fyodor Dostoevsky. Naturally, as a teacher of Russian literature and a sports fan, I was very excited. Wow, an intellectual goal, who clearly, you know, might be an existentialist. He may ponder the relationship between God and man in the modern world. Then reading on, however, I came upon a laconic comment to the effect that Dostoevsky had taught him how to love my fatherland. He's talking about the other Dostoevsky. Not too long after that, a colleague from Russia declared to me with some irritation that to her, Dostoevsky was a shallow, unoriginal thinker. Somewhat taken aback, I tried to counter with The Grand Inquisitor, The Underground Man, indeed, Crime and Punishment. But again, I had missed the point. She impatiently waved her hand, as only Russians can do, and started a rant about Slavophilism. Fortune is teaching. It's also culture. The thing is, there are, in fact, two Dostoevskys, or actually more than two, Bill pointed out. I'll be talking about two, though, the artist and the political commentator. The former, who is especially revered in world literature, is daringly modern and preternaturally perceptive in his explorations of the human psyche. Whatever you might think specifically of Crime and Punishment, I'm sure you agree with that. He is a writer who impressed, among others, Nietzsche and Freud, and he influenced French existentialism. The latter, though, is very much of his time, perhaps articulate and robust in his polemics, and certainly much more nuanced a polemicist, as Bill pointed out, than sometimes his reputation suggests. But he is comparatively unoriginal in this, and what is worse, at various times he's given to all manner of other prejudices. I fear that this is the Dostoevsky acclaimed by unreflective present-day patriots and dismissed out of hand by more than a few Russian intellectuals. Scholars have long marveled at this coexistence of such a starkly incongruous duality in one mind. Dostoevsky's greatest biographer, who's been referred to many times already, Joseph Frank, calls it, quote, part of the mystery of the human personality, unquote, while the historian of nationalism, Hans Kohn, sees it as, quote, one of the great mysteries of the human mind. But perhaps an even greater mystery lies in the fact that Fyodor Dostoevsky, in his greatest work, did not let the crude editorialist dictate to the brilliant artist. This, of course, is in stark contrast to his great contemporary Leo Tolstoy, who had a hard time resisting the temptation to harangue his readers, sometimes to the detriment of his purely creative vision. And that was part of the gist of the talk of Anna Karenina I gave 10 years ago. Philip Robb wrote of Crime and Punishment in much the same tone as we just heard with Frank and Cone, that the success of Crime and Punishment is a measure of the victory scored by the imaginative artist over the ruthless polemicist. For Robb, however, part of the wonder lies precisely in the synthesis of all these contradictions in, quote, in a single brain, in a single psyche. For we have to remember, it's not that the artist ignores the issues that exercise the editorialist. Rather, he manages to treat them in greater depth on the level of individual choices, and thus he universalizes them. And novels in the 1860s and 70s, then, are allowed to become more than about, say, atheism among young Russian radicals, or about the shortcomings of post-reform legal system. They can be read as about the universal conflict between reason and faith and the psychological effect of guilt, among many, many other topics that still engage us now. In the same way, of course, we don't read Hamlet as an informative vignette from Danish history, or King Lear, which was brought up yesterday, in order to learn about the royal houses in ancient Britain. With this in mind, what I would like to do today is try and get at the polemical content that exists very much so in Crime and Punishment, precisely through a literary image that I believe the author is subtly interrogating at the same time, the famous, even then, image of the superfluous man. And Bill touched upon this a bit in his talk, which is just the various kinds of literature that Dostoevsky was referring to. Dostoevsky really liked to interrogate strictly literary images or characterizations in his work. His first two works, Fourfold and The Double, were extensive interrogations of various scenes from Gogol, like challenging them, reworking them, trying to make them more realistic. As for the publicistic aspect of the novel, Joseph Frank convincingly demonstrates in both his biography and in his separate article how it can in fact be read as part of Dostoevsky's ongoing dispute with the Russian radicals, which can be summarized thusly. The writer was appalled by the Western quote-unquote rationalism, crude determinism, and atheism of the nihilists, and always opposed these things to what he sees as purely Russian spirituality. Russia's intellectual elite, he argued, needed to return to their roots, to their native soil, as it were, forego their arrogance and learn humility from the simple Russian peasant who ardently believes in the purest form of Christianity, Russian Orthodox. This, in a very tiny nutshell, shell, is what is called Dostoevsky's Slavophilism, or Pochinichestvo, a word often used by Dostoevsky and his colleagues that basically implies returning to one's roots or one's soil. Seen in this light, Frank says, Crime and Punishment is an attempt to portray the inescapable contradictions in the radical ideology of Russian nihilism. I'll be saying nihilism and nihilism. Now, I certainly won't attempt here to recreate Frank's entire argument. Suffice it to say that in it, Raskolnikov can be interpreted as a nihilist whose utilitarian rationalism runs, quote, counter to the instinctive promptings of his moral and motive sensibility, which is basically Russian and Christian. And Frank emphasizes that the two adjectives for justice are essentially synonymous. Now, every student of Russian literature knows the superfluous man. The term was coined by Ivan Turgenev in his 1850 story, and the type is especially connected with him. The superfluous man prototype is country and is, in the words of the Encyclopedia of Russian Literature, in disharmony with the world. Often gifted, especially so in some ways, he nonetheless has no outlet for his abilities and therefore does nothing. Sometimes he dithers like Hamlet. Turgenev compared the type in another article to Shakespeare's tragic hero. Sometimes he wastes his gifts in various kinds of pointless activity, which we can see in Mikhail Lermontov's malicious, cynical Grigory Kachurin. And sometimes he can't even get out of bed on Charles Oblomov. Often he's just a poseur, as can be said of the father of them all, Eugene Onegin, from Pushkin's novel in verse of the same name. The superfluous man is usually bored to the point of ennui, and in Russian literature, almost always, he's given a foil of a beautiful, bright, active woman who sees the good in him and could, if allowed, redeem him. But of course, that never happens. So the superfluous man remains alone in his inertia. There are many, many famous superfluous men in Russian literature, but I will refer to just these three. Eugene Onegin, of course, is the most famous. Charming, charismatic, smart, but adrift. He has no fixed occupation and lives in the social world of Gogol, an independently wealthy young aristocrat in Petersburg. Clothes, casual love affairs, sumptuous dinners with his companions, etc. But when we meet him in chapter one, he's been bored with all of this and depressed. His uncle dies and leaves him in the country estate, so he leaves the city and dabbles in state manager for a while. A naive young woman from a neighboring state, Tatiana, falls in love with him. He kills his friend Lensky, the fiance of Tatiana's sister, in a pointless duel, and then goes off and hits the road. At the end, he meets Tatiana again in Petersburg. Now she is married and the queen of high society, precisely because she refuses to play the same tired old society game that Lord Eugene. He seemingly falls in love with her, or is he just playing another role? In any case, it's too late, and ultimately, Tatiana doesn't have anything to do with it. A different take is found in Lermontov's The Hero of the Time from 1941, which actually contains within it a parody of Eugene Onegin. It consists of five stories, and the longest story, Princess Mary, can be interpreted as a kind of parody of Onegin. Unlike Onegin, Kachurin does have an occupation. He's an officer stationed in Caucasus during the First Chechen War, but we hardly ever see him act in that capacity. Like Onegin, he basically hangs around and socializes and professes to be profoundly bored. Very much unlike his older cousin, however, who in the end is basically a decent soul, Kachurin is vicious and manipulative. He consciously makes the charming Princess Mary fall in love with him, only to heartlessly reject her. And the duel he fights, he basically provokes. He hectors the feckless Grushnitsky into fighting fatal duel with him. Boredom, in this case, leads him to ruin other people's lives. Yet another variant is the title character of the 1859 novel, Oblomov. Like Onegin and Kachurin, Ilya Oblomov is seen by others as unique and gifted, but he does even less than they do. I mean, it takes him 120 pages just to get out of bed in part one. And throughout the novel, he is maddeningly irritating. His effervescent lady friend is Olga Ilinskaya, who works overtime, double overtime, to try and revive the spark of life in him, but eventually she gives up. Now, the late Oxford philosopher and intellectual historian Isaiah Berlin discusses the superfluous man as precisely a romantic type tracing him ultimately to Goethe's Werther and Chateaubriand Vernet, who in the end, quote, die uselessly because they belong to a society which is incapable of making use of them. They are superfluous because they have no opportunity of asserting themselves against the fearful opposition of the society in which they live. This is basically how Russian commentators originally viewed Onegin et al. In Frank's words, conditions in Russia offer no arena to their ability. However, this view was shifting by the early 60s. Alexander Herzen wrote of this time that, quote, the day of the Onegins and Pechorins is over. Anyone who does not find work now has no one else to blame for it. And one of the most influential of the new radical critics, as Bill mentioned, Nikolai Dobroyuva, wrote a withering broadside against this figure in his review of Oblomovitis, What is Oblomovitis, 1859. Here he acknowledges the superfluous man of the Russian type, but for him it's a purely negative, not tragic figure. He sees no meaning in life. He does not wish to work or do anything for the common good. He views the rest of humanity with contempt. And he is incapable of love or friendship. Here the critic sees a perfect snapshot of the Russian aristocracy in general, and he praises Goncharov for finally displaying the type in his true colors, quote, reclining on a soft couch instead of standing on a beautiful pedestal, wearing a wide dressing gown instead of an austere cloak, unquote. But he still excoriates the writer for having his other characters constantly praised, i.e. quote, certainly he would not bow down to the idol of evil because he would be too lazy to get up off his couch. Dostoevsky himself entered this fray in at least two articles in the first issue, the early issues of Time. And he, of course, further elaborated his thoughts in his famous Pushkin speech in 1880. In the very first issue of Time, he basically takes up Herzen's point and obliquely supports Dobroyuva's critique as well. He declares that it is time for these fine, superfluous men to devote themselves, quote, to the humdrum task of bettering the lot of their fellow Russians. Why, he argues, simply teaching one child how to read would make a world of difference. He then imagines the Pechorins et al. Taking umbrage. Quote, is that an activity for people like us who conceal titanic powers in our breasts? Can a giant teach a child to read? And then, in his own voice, Dostoevsky responds laconically that they should sacrifice all their titanism for the common. Take a 5-inch step instead of a 7-leap. This was part of Dostoevsky's style as a journalist. He would put arguments in his opponent's mouth and then debate with them. Later in 1861, he offered a reading of Eugene Onegin, however, in which he first developed what would become his fundamental position on the superfluous man prototype. He returns to the latter, the more dignified status of tragic figure. Onegin represents educated Russia at the moment when, having assimilated Europeanism through its every pore, it becomes conscious that it could never be truly European and was confronted with the problem of its historic destiny. In search of a new ideal to replace the old European one in which it is no longer fully able to believe. For Dostoevsky, the fact that so many subsequent writers went on to elaborate a new version of this type only shows how important it is for educated Russians. Frank points out that the search for a new ideal, quote, became identified for Dostoevsky with a rediscovery of the values of the Russian common people. The tragedy for Dostoevsky was that the intelligentsia, with its superficial Western patina, fatally alienated from the Russian people and the deeply cherished Russian Orthodox faith. This was the shocking lesson he had learned in the camp in Siberia. Interestingly, Frank mentions in this connection the evil, sinister Stavrogin of demons as a Dostoevskian, quote, reincarnation of Ian Yeagan. This would imply that the most important redaction of the type for Dostoevsky was, in fact, less the empty but relatively benign of Yeagan, the irritating but sweet-tempered Abramov, and more the cold-hearted Turing. This also leads us back to Isaiah Berlin's essay on romanticism, for Berlin sees in romantic literature the important variation of the superfluous type, the great sinner, quote unquote, the figure, quote, who wishes to raise to the ground a society whose system of values is such that a superior person who truly understands what it is to be free cannot operate in terms of it and therefore prefers to destroy it. Sir Isaiah calls the great sinner, quote, one of the great motifs in the Romantic movement and dates it as far back as the 1760s, the plays by Lessing. He also ties it in so many words to Dostoevsky's proto-Nietzschean system, i.e., for our purposes, to Sidra Thyla. And I think for us in Russian studies, we would not necessarily immediately connect this type with the superfluous name. So what I'm proffering here is a hypothesis that I'm just starting to play with, that Dostoevsky is exploring the superfluous man mythos in the figure of Raskolnikov. He's doing it subtly in ways that he, like he always does when he's interrogating other writers' images. And it's very easy to miss in everything else that's going on in him. But he's repeatedly using words and images that would have been immediately understood by his contemporaries that not only conjure up the other characters I've mentioned, all of which his readers knew intimately, but also the topic of debates that referred to. There are crucial differences to the prototype that Dostoevsky introduces, which I'll go into in some detail later on. For now, I will make just two points. First, in Raskolnikov, Dostoevsky is basically taking the old stereotype out of the aristocratic drawing room and putting him in the real world of the 1860s. He's actually having to deal with the real world of the time. I would say that in this, he's essentially, again, echoing Herzen and Dr. Lubov's contention that Russian society at this point needs something more than the old superfluous man might be able to offer. Secondly, unlike Onegin, Pechorin, Warmoth, and their brethren, who are essentially already finished products, Raskolnikov, like all of Dostoevsky's important heroes, is still very much a work in progress. He is becoming, and our understanding of the epilogue is connected with this. Process, not finished state, is also always very important to Dostoevsky. This, I think, is the crux of Dostoevsky's argument here. Raskolnikov himself knows that he now has to act. And the point is that he's faced with various choices in how to do so. The similarities Raskolnikov shares with his superfluous brethren are many, and they are presented in ways that would have immediately connected him to them in the reader's mind. What is more, they hearken back to what Dobrolyubov said about the type of a few years before. Most striking is Raskolnikov's at least very occasional inactivity. He's always in a hurry, Razumikhin tells Raskolnikov's mother and sister on page 215 of our text. Always too busy, yet he lies there and does nothing. That sounds awfully like Oblomov, as does Raskolnikov's self-characterization. what are people most afraid of? A new step, their own word. That's what they're most afraid of. I babble too much, however. That's why I don't do anything, because I babble. However, maybe it's like this. I babble because I don't do anything. I've learned to babble over the past month, lying in a corner day in, day out, thinking about stupidness. I would point out that babble, Baltaj, the Russian word, is a significant word in this context, too. In Turgenev's 1862 novel, Fathers and Sons, the radical Bazarov, who's supposed to be a leader, a man of action, says that the older generation is supposed to have meant has done nothing but Baltaj. Finally, let us consider an exchange in Part 1, Chapter 3, between Raskolnikov and the maidservant. Page 29 in our translation. She asked him, "You say you used to go and teach children before, so why don't you do anything now?" "I do something," he said reluctantly and sternly. "What do you do?" "Work." "What work?" "I think," he replied seriously after a pause. Nastasya simply dissolved in laughter. She was the sort much given to laughter, and when something made her laugh, she laughed inaudibly, heaving and shaking her whole body until she made herself sick. It is telling that Nastasya, who was a wonderful character, even the most secondary characters in Dostoevsky, are given a very striking personality. I just love Nastasya. She's one of the few purely peasant people of purely peasant origin in the novel. It's telling that she laughs at the notion that thinking could be considered work. And throughout the early parts of the novel, of course, she has no patience with Raskolnikov, quote, lying around like a sack and no good to anybody. And she's constantly yelling at him, literally yelling at him, "Get up! Quit your snoring! God, he just lies around in bed all day and doesn't do anything." I think the social symbolism, given that this is one of the ideas in the air at the time, would not have been lost on Dostoevsky's reader. Raskolnikov is alienated from his fellow humans. We are repeatedly told that he is alone, he's not used to crowds, has almost no friends, his audience contemptuous. Let's return to Razumihin's characterization of Raskolnikov for his mother. "Can I tell you? I've known Rodion for a year and a half. Sullen, gloomy, arrogant, proud. At times he's not hypochondriac at all, but just inhumanly cold and callous. Sets a terribly high value on himself, and it seems not without a certain justification. And he doesn't love anyone, and maybe he never will." This is exactly what Gavril Lyubov had said about the superfluous men. "They hold all people in contempt. They are totally incapable of loving, and they have no more idea about what to seek in love than they have about what to seek in life in general." He goes on about how they look down on all the rest of humanity. As I've suggested already, this makes Raskolnikov certainly closer to Pechorin, who, in the words of Gavril Lyubov, quote, "tramples everyone else underfoot." But Onegin, too, is basically shown as isolated, even when out in the town. There's a wonderful scene in Chapter 2 after he's moved to the country, which shows him escaping out the back door as his new neighbors come in the front. And then at Tatiana's name day party in Chapter 5, he spends his time dreaming up sarcastic caricatures of all the other guests. Many people come to visit Oblomov, but he is shown as clearly ambivalent about having company. And most of his friends either nag at him to do something or try to swindle him. Meanwhile, Pechorin certainly cannot love anyone except selfishly, and knows that himself. And early on in Eugene Onegin tells Tatiana the same thing. Other more specific images connect Rodya with all these other characters. most important of these, of course, is Napoleon, who becomes the symbol of Raskolnikov's great man theory. He repeatedly invokes the French icon when he's contemplating stepping over. Napoleon is also associated with at least two other superfluous men, a bloom of two daydreams of being Napoleon. And this passage was quoted with commentary specifically in the Lubos article. When Tatiana visits Onegin's deserted house after the duel that killed Lenski, she discovers a statuette of the French journal on the desk in his study. In the two earlier novels, Napoleon is thus somewhat ambiguous a figure, not purely the romantic symbol that he became throughout Europe, but kind of connected with empty dreams and romantic posture. Undoubtedly, this would have added a dimension of irony to the symbol of crime and punishment, in turn adding to the suggestion of Raskolnikov. Incidentally, Tatiana also discovers a thick layer of dust on the books in Onegin's library, an image that could have been evoked when we read of all the dust-covered notebooks on Raskolnikov's table, again a symbol of intellectual posturing and inactivity. As already mentioned, both Onegin and Pechorin fight fatal duels in their respective novels. Could these possibly be replicated or suggested in the verbal jousting between Raskolnikov and Pechorin and Svidrigaïlov as well? Speaking of fate, Pechorin is forever wailing that it is fate which is causing him all these terrible things. Fate has always seemed to bring the end of the denouement of other people's lives. How many times have I played the part of an executioner's act in the hands of fate? Thus he muses, even as we see him consciously, very consciously manipulating the unfortunate trusting souls all around him. Fate for Pechorin is a cheap way to avoid responsibility for his choices. Raskolnikov, too. He argues that the murder is his way of taking a new step. It's his own new word. He who dares much will be right and will take power over the trembling vermin, the antis, etc., etc. Yet, it's fate's fault that he happens to hear in the Haymarket that the pawnbroker will be home alone the following evening of 1867. It's like suddenly his fate is predetermined and he has total control over what he does. It's because of fate that he slips up in the end. He even tells Sonia that it was the devil who killed the old woman. That's, you know, the devil made me do it. You know, not my fault. As with Pechorin, fate is a convenient excuse for when Raskolnikov makes bad choices that are not free will. Finally, Dostoevsky seems to echo his own ironic reflections on how the superfluous man can make himself useful. Only he's one child to read. In the same exchange with Nastasya, already referred to, Raskolnikov says that he spits on his teachers. They pay small change for children. What can one do with mere kopecks, etc.? And he declares that he wants to get a whole fortune all at once. He clearly thinks that he is too much of a titan. I've already suggested the differences between Raskolnikov and Onegin and the others would have been just as significant to Dostoevsky's reading, if not more. First, let's consider the first point I made earlier. In Raskolnikov, Dostoevsky can be seen as taking the older prototype out of landowner fiction, which is basically how he characterized the work of Tolstoy, Turgenev, and placing him in the real world of the modern city. Here, the superfluous man isn't aristocratic at all. He's a provincial and a rather genius, an urban intellectual without obvious class affiliation. Although it's interesting how many lower class characters call Raskolnikov the gentleman. The convicts say that gentleman, too. And somebody said, well, it's hard to tell who's aristocratic. He's walking on the main streets of the Petersburg slums. He doesn't have Onegin's carriage of the Turin's fine horses. And like it or not, he's forced to interact with other people there. He's part of the cityscape that flits by Onegin's carriage window as he returns home at dawn and turns on the town. In this connection, the urban setting, of which we'll hear much later in Julie's talk, is noteworthy in and of itself, for to a large extent, the old superfluous man is a creature of the countryside. For most of Eugene and Onegin, the hero is in the country. Turin has abandoned Petersburg for the romantic / exotic crossover. When we first meet Oblomov, he is living in a city apartment, but he dreams of the country, and he winds up moving to the semi-rural outskirts of town, where he thinks in his natural, lethargic state. But again, of much greater significance is the fact that Raskolnikov is not yet fully blue. Crime and Punishment can be read as a unique field wound in the mind. For like virtually all of Dostoevsky's protagonists, he's a very young man dealing with the process of development, faced by the choices that will help mold many years ahead. Porfiry Petrovich tells him as much on page 460, I'm a finished man, but you are fighting. Onegin and Pechorin, on the other hand, are what they are. Pechorin knows very well that he will never change, and we don't believe Onegin when he implies that he has at the end. Olga, the Oblomov's Tatiana, as she finally gives him up as a bad job, she's just so upset, exasperated, she's crying. She says that a dead man could have been awakened by all that I did for you. No, Raskolnikov knows very well that the time for lying around with a sack has long since passed, that it is time to act. And the choice he makes basically moves him from Isaiah Berlin's type 1 superfluous man, who perishes, to his type 2, the great sinner, the superman, to whom all was committed and who wants to destroy society. But we know how that works out for him. He might have stepped over one of the phrases he repeated throughout the text, but nothing good came of it. He basically just added to the world's store of evil and damaged himself in the process. There were many other choices proffered, most of which he spits on or ignores. He specifically rejects the 5-inch steps Razumihin cheerfully takes. Lessons, translating, little publishing ventures. One of the things that's interesting in Crime and Punishment is very anti-deterministic. Everybody in that novel is poor, but everybody has their own attitude towards poverty. Poverty doesn't make them into one particular type. That's one of the things that's always fascinating. That the great sinner option was manifestly the wrong one for him is brought painfully home by his encounters with Skylar. Now this is truly someone to whom all is permitted. But in the end, Raskolnikov is forced to see him for what he is. The emptiest and most paltry villain in the world. Another salient difference between Raskolnikov and the early characters that greatly complicates the choices facing him. He may be aloof, but he is not alone. Onegin has no surviving family and no close friends, except perhaps for the garrulous narrator who claims to be. We hear even less of Pechorin's family ties, and even though he's a soldier, arguably the most collective of all professions, we never see him working harmoniously in the unit. Talked about Oblomov, he has no surviving family. that Raskolnikov is someone loved. He is very close to his mother and sister. Razumihin is, in Dunya's words, in awe of him and does all he can to help him. He moves to Raskolnikov's neighborhood, goes out of his way to get him clothed and fed. Sonia falls in love with him, as do, actually, when you think about it, many of the other characters who encounter him, both male and female. This is a point that Ron Christensen made in his book. These relationships with other people bind him to life in the real world in spite of his proto-Nietzschean potential. Why do they love me so? He asks in part 6, page 5.1. If I were alone and no one loved me, and I myself had never loved anyone, none of this would be. It is this love that calls him to act in the first place, in part 1, after he reads his mother's letter, pages 44, 45. It's necessary to do something now, he tells himself. Do you understand? How are you going to protect them from the Svidrigailovs, you future millionaire, you Zeus? And then there's Sonia. She represents yet another choice for Raskolnikov, the way of self-sacrificing love, faith, humility, embracing of living life. She can be his salvation, and in this, she is roughly like the female characters in the earlier novels, although she's worlds different from that character. The females in the other novels cannot save their male counterparts. But Sonia, let's talk about her success for life. We know that when he wrote Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky had already invested the superfluous man trope with great socio-political significance. In Onegin et al., he saw educated Russians at a crossroads, faced with a choice between Europe and Russia, defined in his own unique way. For Dostoevsky, the polemicist, the choice facing Raskolnikov was always between Western atheistic rationalism and genuine Russianism. Deeply religious, humble, meaning. This is what Sonia means for him. And in earlier drafts, Dostoevsky made it starkly clear, putting heavy-handed monologues in her mouth that are wildly incongruous with the Sonia we know from the final text. Machulsky quotes some of these passages. Again, they're from the notebooks that Robin talked about yesterday, which are just a fascinating look into the legislative world. He has Sonia say in the draft, like Christ, the Russian people have always suffered. Arithmetic comes to naught, but spontaneous faith saves. Everything has been confused. One does not know in what to believe. One does not know in what to take a stand. Believe in the beauty above the Russian form. Here we are reminded that he also interprets Tatiana, again a very different character, in exactly the same way in her relationship to Yegin. She is the Russian element that could save him. Although Onegin is far too gone to be saved, at the end of Crime and Punishment, it is implied that Raskolnikov eventually does choose Sonia's way, although it is true that we leave him still in a state of flux. He seems to choose Sonia's way at the end of the epilogue, but the outcome is left vague, and we are left somewhat in doubt. And as Robin pointed out yesterday, Machulsky isn't buying it at all, and calls Raskolnikov's putative salvation, so the power flies. In any event, even if he does follow Sonia, his redemption will be a gradual, difficult process. And again, you can't stress too often with Dostoevsky that the emphasis is always on the process. He is, though, after all, still very young. He will only be in his early 30s when he leaves prison. And one is tempted to say, when he gets out of prison, he'll be 33, the age when Jesus began his mission. Let's not go there, but you know, you're invited to think that. Whatever else happens when he gets out, he will be active. No longer will he be just lying like a sack in bed and dreaming of poopoo. For us, reading this remarkable novel in the 21st century, or as Kolmikov's redemption, is personal and spiritual. Dostoevsky, in the end, spares the delicate Sonia of all of his rather ham-fisted Slavophile ways, and the Russian element in his hero's salvation is only subtly suggested. For us, reading in America in the 21st century, we can miss those suggestions, and our appreciation of the novel will not really suffer in any way. Again, we marvel at the mystery that confronts us in Dostoevsky, the visionary poet and the often pugnacious publicist coexisting in one mind, and the fact that the latter, as pugnacious and loud as he could be, politely yields to the former when it counts the most in his greatest work. This is what makes him so alive for us now. Let me end with a quote from one of Fyodor Mikhailych's collaborators on time. Bill mentioned Nikolai Straka. For Straka, in his memoirs, he writes, Dostoevsky had an unusual mind. He, so to speak, felt thought with unusual liveliness. Above all, he was an artist. He thought in images and was guided by feeling. And in this, I'm reminded of something I encountered in Milan Kundera's, the Czech novelist, book about the novel, The Art of the Novel. It's not his idea. He's quoting somebody else to the effect that an artist's job is to ask questions, not provide answers. That's one of the things that Tolstoy wrestled with all the time. Tolstoy really wants to give you answers. Dostoevsky, although the journalist Dostoevsky seems to know the answers, the artist in him is constantly just asking questions that have perhaps no definitive answer, which is another point that Robin made. In any event, Straka's comments are no better testament for a writer who aimed for the topical and struck the universal. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.